Welcome to the Centre for Army Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Lieutenant Colonel Dean Canham, heading up the British Army's Centre of Excellence for Leadership. I'm joined for this episode by Dr. Victoria Carr. Vic is a reserve officer in the British Army's Intelligence Corps and a primary school head teacher. She holds senior fellowships at the Centre for Army Leadership and Collective Ed at Leeds Beckett University. She's a CMI Chartered Manager and Fellow of the Chartered College of Teaching. Vic is also an author and TEDx speaker who focuses on leadership and the power of language, and who also advocates the social imperative for those in leadership positions to actively create opportunities for transformative interactions with others. She's been a keynote speaker at an array of military and educational leadership events, including recently at the World Education Summit and the Defence Women's Network Conference. She has three MAs in Leadership, Equality and Diversity, and Modern War Studies with Contemporary Military History. Her doctorate is in Leadership and Politics. She published her first book, Leading with Love, in 2023, and is working on two more, one on school improvement and one on Army officer recruitment since 1660. Vic, thank you for joining us at the Centre for Army Leadership. It's an absolute pleasure to have you along. You've got a huge portfolio of stuff that we could talk about, but since it's the Centre for Army Leadership and we focus on that subject, the first question we tend to ask people is whether they have a personal approach or philosophy on leadership.
Well, firstly, thank you for having me. I don't have a personal philosophy, I don't think, but I wonder if people have said about me in the past that I do have one, which is around being transformational. I feel like that's something that other people can say about me. I feel like my approach is perhaps just to work as a good team member. I would say I've got a collaborative approach to leadership, and I wonder if that's what underpins my philosophy. I spend a lot of time wondering about my philosophy of leadership. And I feel like over the years, I've perhaps evolved into an eclectic type of leader. So I think other people's view of you as a leader can sometimes be different to the view that you hold of yourself. But I would say definitely I'm a collaborative person. So therefore, that comes through my leadership.
So would you say that your leadership has a particular style, a way that you approach it? Or do you think that you can adapt the style to the situation and the people that you're dealing with?
I feel like over the years that I have been a leader in a couple of different contexts, I have developed an eclectic repertoire where I feel like I can adapt my type of leadership to suit the situation. So having situational awareness is really important. And that's what indicates the kind of leadership decisions and the kind of leadership behaviors you need to display, whether that's an acute situation where you need to have more of a command role or whether that's a kind of ongoing, more collaborative approach. Just depends on the situation, I think.
Yeah, and we look really closely at the links between command and leadership at the Centre for Army Leadership because of the nature of the Army and authority vested in individuals' ranks and their posts. But we'd also hope that most people could rely on leadership rather than having to resort to authority in getting people to do what is needed to be done. And we also have lots of links into how people are managed by leaders rather than managed by managers as well. There's a bit of nuance in those other links. Do you think that across all of the attributes and character traits of leaders that you see, that there's one in particular that you would say is absolutely essential, preeminent amongst the others?
I think scholars have been studying this for hundreds of years, and I think it's true. If they haven't come up with an answer to it, I'm highly unlikely to, really. But I do think that there are things that people look to in the people who lead them. And I think it's far easier to make command decisions and take command when people are satisfied that you lead them well all the rest of the time. Certainly in my experience leading a school, but I think in my early, my kind of burgeoning experience in peacetime in the Army, I've seen that people are far more likely to listen to people in command if they have respect for them and they've been led well by them over time.
Yeah, a recognition that a transactional, more directive approach is fine in the right situations, but you can't be that way all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not necessary as well, because there are times in the Army where coaching styles are really important, particularly when you're bringing on junior officers or, you know, newly enlisted privates or what have you, and particularly in training environments. I've personally been through the training environment in the recent years, so I can't comment on what's gone before, but in the last 5 years that I've been part of it, I feel like there's definitely a collaborative approach and a more coaching style for people going through those training experiences. My own son's been through it as a junior soldier, so I would say that there is a time and a place for everything, and I think the army becoming much more adept at doing that than perhaps it has been seen before.
I think so. And we do espouse that there is a focus on people's emotional intelligence and their social intelligence in their leadership development before they then get on to the actual skills and techniques that are required, the practical aspects of their job. Because if you've got a good foundation in emotional and social intelligence, you're probably going to be much more successful in applying your skills in the longer run.
Absolutely. And that's with your colleagues as well as with people that you lead. So if you've got any kind of leadership responsibility, be that as a section commander, as a corporal or what have you, then it's almost an unwritten responsibility that you do have the expectation upon you to support those people that you are leading. And I think that's really important. And I've definitely seen it. So I would say I've personal experience of it. Whether that's happened before is a whole different conversation, but it's good to see.
If we can look at your personal leadership development a bit, we'll go all the way back to when you were a kid, if that's all right. You're on the record talking about how positively impactful school was in particular to you, and particularly given what were difficult circumstances at home, to say the least. Can you trace the roots, you think, of your development as a leader all the way back to that point as well?
Well, I think that one of the key skills personally for me, and I can only talk about my own leadership experiences, but perhaps other people will have some kind of affinity with me when I talk about it. But I think for me, one of the key things that I have got is resilience. And I think that did begin as a child, unwittingly perhaps. And I've only come to that realization in recent years on reflection. I think being a reflective leader is really handy because you can kind of look at your own journey and where you've developed skills and perhaps gone wrong and put yourself right or sought help from other people or been coached to become a better person. But I think going back to my childhood, I had to become resilient. My school experience taught me about safety and about emotional safety and psychological safety. And I think that's what I try and create in my own school, but it's also what I try and create as a junior officer, really, amongst my soldiers, who I obviously lead in the Army Reserve space. So I think having that psychological safety means that you can encourage people to challenge you or to speak openly about things that are perplexing them, and they can ask for help without fearing, you know, any kind of retribution from that. So I think tracing it back to my childhood, definitely resilience. I think I was helped a lot by a lot of people through my early childhood and then into my secondary school years. I think people in the Air Cadets definitely encouraged me, and also doing Duke of Edinburgh Awards. Mm-hmm. They taught me to be self-reliant as well, and that I did have the skills needed to be doggedly determined to succeed. And I think all of those things have stood me in good stead as a leader, because there have been times, particularly in my current school, in the early days where, you know, it was quite challenging and I did have to dig deep, and relying on that kind of dogged determination that developed as a small child and then has kind of carried me through, I think has been really beneficial. So I do kind of trace it back, but I wouldn't say that that was obvious to me all the way through. I think in my mid to late 40s, I've had a great opportunity to look back and reflect on how I've arrived at the place I am today, from being asked to write a book and also being asked to do a TEDx talk. I think that gave me cause to stop and think back to where I had travelled from and to. And from that, I think being self-reflective is really important. And I think as leaders, we often don't have time to perhaps think about what we're doing or think about the impact of what we're doing, but just taking that time out can be really beneficial.
Yeah, we try to encourage people to look inwards first if they want to develop their leadership, but you do have to devote a bit of time to it, and time is very precious for everyone. But actually making that difference, doing those little incremental gains, starting with yourself, looking after yourself, developing yourself, has got to be the first step before you're then in a position to lead other people well, we would say.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I wrote about it in my book, and I always start with self anyway, not from a selfish or egotistical perspective, but what do I bring to the table? What have I brought to this particular situation? Especially if something's gone wrong, I seek to understand what I've perhaps contributed to it, wrong or right, and where it could have been made better. But also I look at the contribution of other people and where they could be developed to bring more to the table in future as well as myself. So I think looking at yourself and what triggers you and what you're good at and being honest about that, which I think is key, because we can all kind of look at ourselves and spend time kind of navel gazing. But unless we're going to be really honest about that brutally with ourselves, not necessarily publicly outing ourselves, but I think being honest about what motivates us and why we're doing things. And if that is career development or promotion or, you know, encouraging others or a societal impact that you want to have or a legacy you want to lead, then that's great. But just be honest with yourself about it, I think. And then you can appreciate then what you've contributed to any given situation, be that good or bad.
Yeah. So perhaps as a head teacher and as a Centre for Army Leadership Senior Research Fellow, it isn't a surprise that you talk about how the power of books has influenced your development since a very young age and the impact they've had on your whole life. Do you think that there are one or two that you would refer people to that would be your go-tos or that tend to work well for people that you come across?
I would say that books are easy places to get lost in. So novels are just nourishing for your soul. You know, as a small child, I didn't really understand the boundaries of the world. I just understood my home and it wasn't a very safe place. So for me, books were a place to live amongst and live within. I think books that we read nowadays, I still do that, by the way. I still read novels from time to time and I just enjoy them for what they are, just a lovely story, because that's the whole pleasure of a reading. But I think for me, reading more kind of instructional, informational, challenging texts to do with all kinds of topics challenges my thinking, enhances my understanding of the world. So I think my go-to books aren't necessarily purist books about leadership. They're books like Sapiens is just one of the most amazing distilled histories of humanity and why we are as we are. And things like Prisoners of Geography teach us, you know, in a very digestible way without having to be a huge academic. Both of those books are on Audible. And if you're not a reader, then you can listen to them, which is often what I do if I'm trying to kind of multitask, which I do have to try and do from time to time. If I'm walking to school, I will listen to a book. So there's always time for me to read and develop my thinking. So they're kind of books I would recommend for people who just want to understand about humanity. And I genuinely think that leadership itself is about relationships and about people and knowing people and what motivates them, therefore knowing yourself and what motivates you. So I think if you're looking at humanity in general and understanding why we are where we are, definitely those books. I mean, books about leadership that I would recommend are the simple ones, things like Legacy, obviously James Kerr. That is just such a simple but brilliant book about service and about, you know, never thinking that you're too good to do what everyone else is doing, and contribution to your team and constantly asking yourself, what have I done for my team today? Be that a sports team or your school team or your work team or you know, your section or your platoon or what have you. To me, those things are transferable across the board. Yeah, so I mean, I will read anything and I'll take from those texts, you know, what I think applies to me. And I think that's the beauty, again, of reading. People take from them what they want. I've read books about Shackleton and his journey, and I think, wow, there's something in there. Was he a leader? Was he a commander? Was he just somebody lucky, an adventurer who ended up being a leader? So I think if you're a thinking person and you approach most things from that angle, then you can pretty much think about anything that you read and analyze it and examine it to make sense to yourself.
Yeah. So amongst your voracious appetite for reading and studying books, you write. So you've got one book published already, you've got two on the way. Your published work is called Leading with Love. It's about how schools, their staff and the pupils can be transformed through having a heart of values, well-being and a positive culture. Love isn't really a word that we hear in association with leadership, not military leadership especially, perhaps. Do you think that it's easier to envisage leading a school with love than a military organization? Or do you think that words like compassion, empathy and familial bonding should be expressed more often through leaders and leadership in the army?
I think it's funny you should say that. So last week for my third book, I interviewed Major General Alistair Bruce, and he talked to me about love with a small L for his soldiers and about when he spent time in the Falklands and when he came back and what he sort of did to support the families of people who he lost out there. And he said he felt that his soldiers understood that, again, he loved them with a small L. And I think too often we confuse love with a kind of physical representation of sexuality or an intimate physical relationship, when actually it can simply be compassion and empathy and love with a small L and just wanting to support people to be the best they can be. So I think that is eminently possible in a military context, because that, I feel, is exemplified in much of what we do. And again, I'm only 5 years in, and perhaps people would argue differently if they've had a long army career or a regular army career, whereas I'm a reservist. but I definitely think I have seen people who are invested in others and who want them to do the best. And to me, that is just an extension of love for our fellow man and love for those people that we work with and alongside. So I think compassion can be seen through all different ways of working. And I think empathy is vital for understanding and for supporting people going through any kind of experience, you know, be that an acute experience that might need some kind of support, trim or whatever. I've just recently done a trim course and it made me think about how where compassion might sit in the military context, or in fact any context where people deal with potentially challenging situations. But I think you can just be empathetic on a daily basis. People are always going through dramas at home with their families or their children or their spouses or their, you know, their parents or what have you. And I think it doesn't need a great deal to just be empathetic towards other people. Mm-hmm. And it can buy you an awful lot in terms of goodwill when it comes to leadership or command decisions further on. If people understand that you're a good human, then they will definitely do things for you that perhaps they may not want to do otherwise.
Yeah. So we've touched briefly on, amongst your many roles and responsibilities and things that keep you very busy, you being the head teacher of a primary school and an officer in the Army Reserves. So aside from love and that being applicable across both careers, do you think there are other common leadership themes that you use in both roles, or do you think there are some that are starkly reserved for one or the other?
I think what I bring to both roles is probably the same. I didn't see initially how it could be that way, but I think over time I've come to understand that it can be. I think when I came here to Sandhurst as an officer cadet, I brought a kettle and biscuits and everyone used my room as a kind of common room. They came to talk to me about their problems and we had coaching sessions. And the irony is that I was feeling very inferior and very much like I shouldn't be there and that was unlikely to pass. And yet I was coaching younger people to have more self-confidence. But that to one side, I was exactly the same with them as I am with my own children, with my family members, and how I am with the people I work with at school. So I think we can bring our own unique brand to anything that we do. In terms of transferable skills, I think being an officer in the reserves means that I often look at MS, you know, report writing and looking after the careers of people junior to me, which is exactly the same as I do in school. I coach people along, I signpost them for career development. I deal with perhaps issues that they might bring to me and then pass them on to people who are more knowledgeable, exactly like I do in school. So I think there are lots of transferable things. I suppose the only thing that isn't transferable from the army back to school life is that at some point in the future, I might be asked to give an order that means someone has to take a life, which is probably the only real difference because that's never happening in a school, frankly. But yeah, I would say that's the only difference, really. Everything else for me is transferable.
And of course, you see young children at work every day, and you talk about how the use of careful and powerful language can inspire them. Do you think, though, that by the time they're moving on from you, that they are already shaped? You can see perhaps the ones that might be leaders of the future, or do you think that there's still a lot of time beyond that for them to develop and become something that you might not have thought they were at the point where they move on?
I definitely don't think that young people are anywhere near the finished article. I look back now at my own life, and again, I'm not outing myself. I've said this in my book, the first one. I think that we often are a product of our circumstances at that time. So I basically survived my childhood and I didn't necessarily do as well as I could have done at school. That wasn't an indication of my intellect or my ability. That was an indication more of the fact that I was struggling to survive my home life. And I suspect there are a lot of young people who do that. I know that there will be a lot of young people in the army, perhaps at the army college, or, you know, new into basic training, who may not have had the best start in life. And that does not define them. That just means that they've survived what came before. And now they have a wonderful opportunity for social transformation in an organization that really is about social transformation. So I think, no, that I don't see that they are in any way the finished article. What we try and create for them in school is a safe space for them to explore what being a good citizen might look like. So we try to instill values like the army do, instill discipline like the army do, but less so about, you know, scary kind of disciplinary type things that you might hear on the news. We don't do any of that zero tolerance stuff. We try and use every experience as a learning experience for children because they are literally making mistakes and it's a safe to fail environment.
Yeah. Do you have the experience of seeing children who perhaps left you a number of years ago, who you thought probably not going to do anything particularly special, who then 5-6 years down the line end up with some huge achievement under their belt.
Well, I try never to think, oh, they're not going to do anything special. I mean, there's so many instances in the public domain where that has been said. I mean, David Beckham once was told he was never going to amount to anything. So I definitely try not to think, even think those things. But certainly people have reached out to me in recent years on Twitter, which makes me feel super old, but also super proud that I've been a part of someone's journey, when they say things like, oh, miss, I was in your year at English class 20 odd years ago, and now I'm a head teacher. And I think, oh, wonderful. And now I feel a million. But yeah, I think it's great when you see people who have made a success of their lives. Definitely. It's very heartwarming. And that's why I know that the job I do is really quite fundamental in terms of society.
Yeah. And you mentioned it a couple of times there about impact on society, and that schools and indeed the army can be transformational for individuals. Do you think that that's well understood, particularly perhaps for people not in the army? People would expect schools to be having that transformational effect. They would hope that it would. But do you think the army is open enough, or people understand it well enough, to realise from outside the great social benefits that can come to individuals that might not otherwise have those opportunities?
I think the media is a funny old thing, and I think it focuses on the wrong things often. And I think the answer is probably no, sadly not. I try my best to champion the army, in fact, the services in general, as organisations who can offer that social transformation to young people and offer them a family where perhaps they may not have had one before. Equally, I think things like rugby. I used to be heavily involved in rugby, particularly girls' rugby. My daughter played once for Cheshire. And I used to often encourage people, you know, to join rugby if they were a little bit lost, because there was something for everyone in a rugby team, in the same way that there's something for everyone in the army. I mean, we joked before we started recording that I'm not an infanteer naturally. You know, my skill set lies in being able to think and analyse, and that is why I have a role in the intelligence corps. And I think there is something for everyone in the army, whatever their skill set is, whatever their perceived level of intellect is. And there is always room for growth. I myself continue to grow, and there's no reason why younger people can't continue to grow. I think the main thing is people within the army should continue to signpost, which they do, the offer to young people as they join. And that's a key responsibility, I think, for everyone serving. And I think perhaps if the media were encouraged to focus more on the positive aspects of the military service, in the same way that they should perhaps focus more on the positives of education, then our society might be better informed about what we can offer.
Yeah. You've got an excellent TEDx talk online, and in it you talk about actually you felt quite limited by yourself at some points in the past, which is difficult to believe when you look through your bio at everything that you've achieved. Imposter syndrome, something which you've overcome to a point, or is it something which still lingers every now and then when you get new challenges that you force yourself to take on, it seems?
I think imposter syndrome is perhaps a legacy issue for many people, not just myself. I know that people, you know, who've done far better things than me also suffer from it, so I know I'm not alone. I wonder if it's to do with your background and your upbringing. I wonder if it's more to do with feeling socially isolated. And I know there's lots of marginalized people who might feel imposter syndrome, but I think for me, I overcame it actually again when I was here. And I think marching up the steps of Old College and thinking, you know, that I'd actually succeeded and achieved something was really quite a monumental moment. Because I'd been told by somebody in the army, actually, in part of the recruiting group, but in part of the recruiting pipeline, that I was highly unlikely to succeed given my age and, you know, who I was and what have you. So that really set me back. But what was so funny about that is I put a post out just before I came here to kind of warn Ofsted, really, that I wasn't going to be available for 4 weeks because we were in an Ofsted window, because they do look at the head teacher's social media. And I thought, at least if they look at it, they'll know where I am. So when they ring my school and they're told I'm not there, they might be a bit more sympathetic. So I put a post out and said, right, I'm off to Sandhurst and I'm absolutely nervous and, you know, I'll see you in 4 weeks' time kind of thing. And the company sergeant major at the time saw my post and so did his friends. And so on my first day here, I was kind of brought to attention by someone who said, the CSM has seen your post and, you know, just be careful what you post on social media. And I thought, I've made such a mistake posting that. And actually, I hadn't, because what I'd done was say to lots of people like me who perhaps were afraid of taking that next challenge, that challenge is possible for anyone, because 4 weeks later, I put a post out that said, I've succeeded. Mm. So, and I think you're right. I think people make judgments very easily on a list of achievements that you might have made without really knowing the reason why. You know, I think, why have I done all those things? Probably to hide away from people, because it was easier to hide in books than it was to deal with people when you felt socially awkward or a bit shy or odd, or like you were on the periphery. It's easier to read books, right? And if you're going to read books, you just get pieces of paper that say you've read a few books and put a few words on a page. It's nothing, anyone can do it.
There must be something, given all of your achievements, that you can teach all of us about time management, because I cannot work out how you manage to fit everything in that you do in your professional career and in your outside interests as well.
Well, I'm not Hermione Granger. I haven't got a time turner, but I hardly watch telly, really. That's probably the secret. And like I said earlier, for me, multitasking isn't trying to do lots of things well at the same time. So for example, I live 10 kilometers from where I work. So if I am building up to doing a raw fitness test, I might put all my stuff in my rucksack / Bergen and walk into school, which takes me about 90 minutes, and I can listen to a podcast or I can listen to an audiobook. So I'm nourishing my brain and reading, and I'm also doing some fears, and I'm also building up to doing something that is a testable thing in the army. So I kind of try and do lots of things that maximize my time, and I compartmentalize time into half hour chunks, and I try and make every half hour work in a really productive way. It makes me sound like I'm really... anal and obsessive. I'm not. I've learned to maximize my time, and I get up early, and I probably don't sleep as much as I could do. And I've probably got a face for podcasts rather than the telly as a result of that. But definitely, I think not watching TV and wasting lots of time on social media, although some people would say, oh, you're always on social media. I'm not. I post things that crop up, and I'm a very quick reader. I've learned over time to read quickly. So yeah, I guess. I don't know how to do it, but I set myself probably far too many goals and then stress myself out trying to achieve them.
You have, though, found time to write two further books.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us a flavour of what each of those is about?
So the first book was about growing into leadership, really. And I guess it was about school specifically, but it was more about growing through what life throws at you to become the person you want to be. So that's why people like Paul Nansen read it and you know, found it valuable. But the second one is definitely 100% about basically turning a failing school, a school struggling, whatever people want to call it, turning that around over a long period of time, and how you need to have the long-term goal in your head rather than short-termism and your own ego. So that's definitely about schools, and it's basically about the school I'm in at the moment. And I was asked to do that on the back of the first book. But then the third one is based on some research I did that began with Professor Clark here at the Cal. So when I first came across him, it was during COVID, and I wanted to do another MA, which I did in military history and modern war studies with Buckingham. And then my research took me down a completely different tack, which I didn't see coming. And by the way, that was the hardest MA I've ever done, because it was completely different to anything I'd done before. A history degree is completely different, kettle of fish. So I learned a lot of new skills in that, painfully, might I add. So that research then went on and informed the Haythornthwaite Review. And that then kind of grew legs of its own. And it was about army officer recruitment, and is being co-authored with my good friend, Lieutenant Colonel Simon Shepherd. The book's about officer recruitment over the entire army history. So since the 1600s until today. Which is really interesting. And as a result of that, I've asked lots of serving officers to provide us with their testimony and their experiences of commissioning, and all of that information will go into National Archives, some of which are held here at the Sandhurst Trust. So that's actually a real labour of love, as opposed to the other two, which are about my experiences in schools and just being a leader, really.
And I bet as those stories come in, there's some real nuggets in there about some quite bizarre either actual experiences or expectations that people have.
Just fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And it's so wonderful to gather that information. It's like a living history. So the oldest person we've had talk to us is in their 90s. So you can imagine their commissioning experience compared to someone who's just recently commissioned is going to be completely different. And it's really interesting to see how each period in history has informed recruitment and so on. I mean, if you're, again, a bit boring and a bit odd like me, then it's interesting. But I think a lot of people will be interested to see what comes out of that. And as I say, a lot of people have contributed and are still to contribute. So it is interesting. You know, like with my research, I was so lucky with that. I went to all the kind of major officer training establishments for all of the services. So I was at Dartmouth College, I was at Limston, I went to Cranwell. I've met some amazing people just as part of that research. I've been very lucky. And that same thing's happening now, to have the opportunity to interview people like, you know, General Zach tomorrow and Alistair Bruce last week and people like that. It's just incredible.
Yeah. That full scope of your different careers that you've got running in parallel, I'm sure people are always quite interested in the highs and the lows and the very highs and the very lows in particular as far as leadership development and experiences go. Perhaps there might be one from either career or a couple that really stick out from others. Those really challenging moments where you think, I've done something right, I've actually made a real positive impact on that situation, and then perhaps also then the converse where you think perhaps it's not gone so well and what you learned from it.
Well, I think where I've got it right, other people can speak about that, really. I think I can definitely say times where I've got it completely wrong, sometimes through naivety, sometimes through, you know, too much passion for what I'm doing. But early on in my first headship, I challenged the director of education like a blunt instrument, which is perhaps what I was back then. And he didn't like it. And although the outcome was our school did get the money that his staff had basically cost us, and it was to the tune of about 20 grand. So it wasn't 5p, it was a lot of cash. And I was very challenging and very robust at the time. But it put me in a lot of hot water with him for a good couple of years. And that was only kind of rescued really when he asked me to take on this current school. And he said, I've observed you over the years and I've seen that, you know, you will fight for what is right and you will fight for the school that you are in charge of and for all of those pupils. And that's why we've asked you to do this particular job. But at the time, it was almost career ending. He basically said to my boss, who's my chair of governors at the time, that they needed to essentially rein me in because he did not like how I had challenged him. And I think if I had my time again, would I have been so challenging? Would I have been so direct? Maybe not. Did the outcome that we needed happen? Yes, it did, but nearly at the cost of my sanity and my career. So that was a huge mistake. And then recently in this school, when I took it over, I made a wrong assumption and I assumed that the people who were in key roles had been coached into those roles the same way I would have coached somebody into those roles. And that hadn't happened. There was a lot going on. It was a very volatile situation. You know, there was huge debt, a lot of instability. And I assumed that somebody had the skills they needed to be able to be robustly interviewed. And that didn't happen. And that person was kind of like watching car crash TV, really. She broke down, she cried. And I felt terrible that I had let her down. You know, I should have known better. I should not have assumed anything. And I let that be a lesson to me about assuming in the future. And I made sure that did not happen again, and nor will it ever in terms of, you know, my leadership. So again, I write about some of that stuff in the second book, which is about obviously school improvement, not Ofsted, by the way. It's about actual authentic school improvement, not just trying to get a good grade. But I think any leader can make an assumption, and by outing myself and the mistakes I've made, I hope that other people think twice about making those same schoolboy errors, really.
You touched on assumption of leadership roles and people's development. It's something which comes up really often in all the conversations I have, both with people in the army, across the wider public sector, and in private companies as well, about how people are given leadership roles because they are technically proficient at their job, but they're given no leadership training, no development at all. It seems to be something which individuals are just expected to know or soak up or develop themselves, whereas actually we recognise that there are really specific ways to make yourself better as a leader or to make people better as leaders, but it just seems to be a gap that's overlooked.
I agree with you, and I think the army is getting so much better at that, having that understanding for junior leaders particularly who have the most exposure to young soldiers. Having that clear expectation of their leadership development will really help them, and then future generations as they get promoted, that will help them, and that kind of cultural shift will be huge. But certainly outside in the world, there is not that clear pathway for leadership development. And it is leadership. It's not command development. It is leadership development at its best. And I think you are only as good as the people who you work beneath and who lead you and who show you the way it can be done. And equally, I've learned from people who've done it really badly in the past. Again, that this comes from age and experience, but I've worked for people who've been dreadful and who've ruined people's careers. They haven't cared, or they've been far too invested in other things, which is a real shame. but that teaches you how not to do it, as well as learning from people who teach you how to do it. So I think each of us can take from that what we will, but certainly out in the world, civilian world, there is no real clear pathway, and you just have to hope that someone is a bit inspired or a little bit, you know, emotionally intelligent enough to see that there is another way to do things, or that there are alternatives, or that there could be something else they could do, like coaching their staff through. I will not have a meeting now on my own. I make sure that my senior staff are with me, not because I'm scared, but so that they can then develop the skills needed to have difficult conversations or pragmatic conversations or challenge people authentically and appropriately, because I've had to learn those skills sometimes the hard way. So isn't it better to encourage people as I go before I just leave overnight or get another job somewhere else? Those people are then empowered to have those conversations and coach through that.
Yeah. That chimes with academic research and studies that we've conducted recently, where if you ask people what the most impactful leader development trait or characteristic is that makes them do something differently, it's people leading by example. People mm-hmm. will copy that which they can see, for good or bad. But actually, if you want people to be better leaders who work for you or that you are leading, then just be a good leader and they will copy what they can see.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, alongside doing the day job, if you like, working in school, being a school leader, I've always done academic study for that reason, because I think keeping abreast of up-to-date research and having your thinking challenged and having the daily practice also informing your thought processes as you're doing that reading and as you're creating research of your own really is valuable, because you can overlay the academic and the theoretical and the conceptual onto your lived experience doing that job, which is why I wanted to do a military-based MA when I joined the army. I thought I need to know a little bit more and understand a little bit more. And as I say, I fell down a different rabbit hole and ended up doing something completely different about recruitment. But even that, nevertheless, was really informed because I had just been through the process as a reservist. You know, it's not completely different, but it is different from a regular experience. But and I've just signed up to do another MA now in global security. So again, my job in the reserves will inform that. And my thinking around what I do in the reserves will be informed by the academic that I will research and, you know, hopefully work with other people on. So I think constantly touching base with the academic and keeping abreast of research is really important to keep your thinking current, and so that you don't fall into an echo chamber with people who just agree with you or yes people. Or that's a cultural thing, isn't it? You don't want people around you going, oh, yeah, you're right. You want people to say, really? Or could it be this? Or could it be that? Or should we look at this? And that's what keeps you fresh.
Yeah, absolutely. And we make a strong point here that everything that we develop, that we push out, that we espouse has got some research and academic credibility behind it. It's not just stuff which a few people sat in camouflage uniforms have sat and made up, because then it's a bit thin. And if people scratch the surface, you might be able to see through it. Everything we do has to have some sort of research grounding if it's going to be really impactful for the current situation, the current social context, and drawing on the best that there is across other sectors and internationally as well.
I think that's what the COW does well, though. You know, there are representatives within the COW that aren't pure military strategists or pure military serving personnel. You know, there's academics, there's people who bridge both of that a little bit, perhaps like me. And then there are people, you know, like yourself, who are serving and have got that length of military experience behind them. So I think having a kind of almost a think tank like that does help, as long as those conversations are open and are, you know, people aren't trying to point score, which I don't think they are in the COW, then I think think tanks like that really do work, because you do get diversity of thought. You get people who are invested in a positive outcome, but who come at it from a completely different perspective and may offer a completely different, you know, idea that hadn't been considered before. So I think that's really healthy.
Yeah. So I say this question as someone who has been chair of governors of a primary school, and therefore I have a bit of experience, not compared to yours daily, but who brings you the most joy and despair? Is it the parents or the children?
The most despair, I would say the government. And the most joy, I would say, for me, it's probably in the staff. So neither of the two that you've said. And I think when you're the head, you invest in your staff knowing that you are one step removed from the children. I can't teach all the children, especially not in a school where there are nearly 600. I can kind of go around and have fun with them, almost like being the best auntie ever, but I'm not the person who's shaping them on a day-to-day basis like their teacher is. So I think if I invest in their teachers and their teachers are happy and well-rounded and their training is up to date, then they are vibrant and the children just love being with them and they want to learn. So I feel perhaps that being one step removed, the joy comes from investing in the adults. And I don't know if that's the same in the army. I'm not sure. Perhaps somebody in a senior position might think, well, I can't influence junior soldiers, but I can influence the people who influence junior soldiers. And I think the higher up you go in a hierarchy, if I was a CEO, for example, of a multi-academy trust, I wouldn't even see necessarily the teachers. I'd have to then look to empowering and inspiring head teachers, for example, or heads of school. So I think each layer up you go, you kind of have less touch with the people, which is why you have to have that open dialogue with people who are going to challenge your thinking, because you can go off on your merry way and make decisions thinking that they're the best and they come from a good place, but they may not have any positive impact because you're not there in touch with what's going on in classrooms with children.
Yeah, we touch on in the doctrine about the difference between what we would militarily recognise as a tactical versus a operational and strategic levels of leadership, and that whilst there are attributes and skills that are common for all of them, there are different ways and there's a different context of leading at those different levels, and mainly to do with proximity to the people that you're trying to impact.
And a sphere of influence. I mean, I suppose we can most influence a culture. And I think, you know, at very senior levels in the military, there are people who are trying to influence a culture. Things like teamwork are trying to influence a whole culture, which is slow changes perhaps, but also very important. But that is only enacted by people all the way through actually getting on board with that. And I think it's the same in schools, exactly the same. That cultural change has got to come from, it's got to be led by really and influenced by the people who are at the highest possible level, but then lived and experienced by everybody else within that community and that organisation.
Yeah, we were really pleased to be asked to be at the absolute core of the Army's most recent plan for improving its culture, which has just been published. And leadership-driven change is the mode through which the Army's decided it's really going to add some jet fuel to improving the culture throughout. And that's a perpetual thing that will continue to happen all the way through into the future as context changes. And
I think having that long-term view is so important, don't you think? Because I think people who do things for 2 years or 5 years and it's politically led or, you know, career-driven for themselves personally, perhaps sometimes some of that long-term thinking gets a little bit lost. And I think having a doctrine and having a long plan that is seen through by successive people because they see the value in it will really create that cultural change, definitely. And I think right now, today, the future CGS is, you know, either newly trained or going through that training pipeline. Do you know what I mean? So I think those are the people who, if you influence them now, will go on and continue to embed that culture and build that culture into long into the future when we're all gone. And for me, that's what legacy means. When we're long gone, will people still believe in being good humans, good leaders, you know, creating good communities and cultures for our subordinates and our team members? And I think that's the legacy.
As far as legacies are concerned, as we sort of start to move towards the end of this conversation, who's the one or two people from your past that you've worked with or seen at work that have been truly inspirational in their leadership?
Well, I think on a personal level, the first ever job I got, there was a guy called Stuart Todd, and he was my head teacher back in Newcastle upon Tyne. I worked in quite a rough area, you know, my first teaching job, and he was instrumental. He was just a brilliant man and an innovative thinker, and really defended all of us as his staff. So I would say on a personal level, him. But I think in terms of kind of big people in history, I suppose I always look to people who've come from marginalized groups and who've, without any agency or any real political backing or finances or power, they've stood up for what is right nevertheless. And so it sounds a bit cliche, but I suppose, you know, looking back at people like Martin Luther King, who had nothing but stood up for what was right and challenged established thinking. And I think that was probably pretty brave. I don't suppose he's my idol or my hero, but certainly there are parts of that story that resonate. And I think he did a really good job. I think people like, as I said earlier, Shackleton, I read a story about him and about his, he was just resolved that he would succeed. And it, you know, he just had that determination. So I think there are parts of that. I think people in history, but it's easy to look back in retrospect. I think people who are now, you know, Michelle Obama, what a great biography she has about her life becoming And I think becoming the people who are meant to be, we're influenced by so many others and looking at the positives in the modern day and also from history, but not just being focused on one person perhaps is the way forward.
Mm-hmm. And looking back, what's the one bit of advice on leadership that you would give to a young Vic as she went off on a leadership development journey?
What would I say? I'd say be kinder to yourself. I suppose I never felt like I was good enough or enough, and over the years that's probably hindered my thinking and limited me so much. I was always, I suppose, courageous, but I didn't see it then. But I suppose just be brave. Be brave and be kinder to yourself, definitely. Because I think we're all too harsh at times, on ourselves particularly.
It's a great bit of advice, then or now. Vic, thank you so much for coming in. It's been a fascinating conversation. Good luck with getting both the next two books complete.
And well, one's with the publisher at the moment, but the other one, well, that's in the offing next year. That'll be out next year.
Great. Look forward to it. Thanks very much. Vic's ability to combine her experience of being head of a school with her military role gives us a unique insight into how two notably different environments and teams can benefit from skills and character traits of great leaders that are transferable across different sectors. She spoke about the development of her personal resilience and emphasised the part it plays in her determination to foster and nurture emotional and psychological safety in the teams she leads now, and how a love of teams by the leaders is not too strong a word to use, even in a military context. She also spoke about the value of personal development, how she has learned from her mistakes, encourages others to do so, and how she has to guard against imposter syndrome despite her numerous significant accomplishments. If you've enjoyed this episode of the podcast, then please share it with colleagues and friends and add your thoughts to the debate on social media. For more information on British Army leadership or to get in touch with the team, search for the Centre for Army Leadership website or find us on all your main social media platforms.